So we'll call that up.
So good afternoon, Chair Corbett and board members. My name is Dan Schultz, and I'm a senior environmental scientist with the State Water Board Division of Water Rights. And I'm here to provide you with an update on the Division of Water Rights implementation of Senate Bill 837, or the Medical Cannabis Regulation and Safety Act. So first, just in general, we always provide this little overview on all our presentations. And throughout this presentation, I'll refer to cannabis cultivation, and it's referring to commercial cannabis cultivation, just so I don't have to say it over and over. Also, you know, just so everybody knows, the State Water Resources Control Board is developing a regulatory program to protect state waters from cannabis cultivation. And the program will cover medical cannabis cultivation on public lands. Cannabis cultivation on public lands is illegal and subject to enforcement. And then lastly, the water boards and state water board and regional water boards not take a stance on cannabis. We take a neutral stance and are not, we don't approve or endorse cannabis cultivation. So a little background, three bills were passed in 2015 by the legislature. There was Assembly Bill 243, Assembly Bill 266, and Senate Bill 643. In June of 2016, Governor Brown signed Senate Bill 837, which basically combined the three bills, cleaned up some of the language in the three bills, and updated them. And also, as one of those updates, renamed it to the Medical Cannabis Regulation and Safety Act from the Medical Marijuana Regulation and Safety Act. So under the Senate Bill 837, the State Water Board is required to ensure that individual and cumulative impacts of water diversion for cannabis cultivation do not negatively impact the flows needed for fish migration, spawning, rearing, and flows for natural flow variability. So this picture you guys have seen before for some of the Russian River regulation, but it just is a nice picture of what happens in pools and rearing habitat as water is continuously diverted and the water quality conditions degrade. So the State Water Board is to develop policies for water quality control, which is very similar to a basin planning activity. And the policies for water quality control will include principles and guidelines that will protect the aquatic habitat, wetlands, riparian, and the flows that we discussed a second ago. These were set up in two ways. There's interim principles and guidelines and long-term principles and guidelines. So right now we're really focused on the interim principles and guidelines. And the way it's basically set up is that when the long-term principles and guidelines are developed, they'll replace the interim principles and guidelines. And I should also add that the principles and guidelines are, you know, very narrowly targeted at cannabis cultivation. And they are not, don't have any impact to ag water use, domestic water use, municipal water use, or any other water use. It's just looking strictly at cannabis cultivation. So principles and guidelines, as I mentioned, are to protect springs, wetland, and other aquatic habitat. And they may also include requirements that apply to groundwater where reasonably necessary. And right now, as one of the components of the interim principles and guidelines, we are looking to include all springs under the principles and guidelines, whether or not they're typically considered regulatory springs or not. And that's just simply looking at the sheer scale of the effort that we're trying to do, and that's usually a spring-by-spring determination. So we didn't cover this one. I'm sorry. The interim principles and guidelines, they can be updated as needed. We're looking to use adaptive management as we go through this, and we'll get into that a little bit more when we start to talk a little bit about what the different principles and guidelines are and the implementation components that we're looking at right now and why that's important. As we mentioned, they're adopted as part of a policy for water quality control, and both the interim and the long-term principles and guidelines qualify as a Class 8 action under CEQA, or the California Environmental Quality Act, which is actions that are taken by regulatory agencies to protect the environment. So for the interim principles and guidelines, We have two main components. There's the flow component, and then there's the non-flow component. So we'll start with the flow component. And basically what we're looking at right now is a surface water forbearance period. This is during the what we're considering the dry period. This time period will vary throughout the state. As you're farther up north, you'll have a longer diversion season. As you move farther south, due to the hydrologic conditions and climate, your diversion season will likely be shorter. And for the wet season, we'll develop flow requirements. And some main components of those flow requirements is to maintain the first flush for flushing of spawning gravels. And then also on the back end, maintaining, trying to protect some of the recession flows to ensure that the species that rely on that receding water and use it for triggers for breeding and other purposes have that those flows there. The other component that we're looking at is conserving some portions of high flow events. High flow events are important for channel maintenance and channel form. Some other components related to non-flow are things like fish screens and removal of any passage barriers, conservation measures such as drip irrigation, diversion rates, those types of things, and then also looking at riparian buffers, to name
Dan,
a few.
If I can ask you a question.
Yes.
And actually, it's probably more a question for Elizabeth or Nathan or John, and I can't believe I'm asking three lawyers at once. But
I'm
going on the edge here. But yeah. Not that I'm opposed to this dry period or matching diversion with the hydrologic variance across the state, but legally, how does that hold up? I mean, commodity aside, we don't do that for grapes, we don't do that for almonds, we're doing it for a commodity. Are we going to get away with that? Somebody?
Can
that be challenged and will it hold up? Because we are saying this commodity you can irrigate X number of months, but if you've got a vineyard next door or an almond orchard, pull the water when you want.
I mean, you ask a difficult question to answer succinctly, because a lot of these things are in development right now. The legislation is new. But in general, you know, the State Water Board has broad authority to regulate the diversions of water, to protect against waste and unreasonable use, and to protect public trust resources. So the authority is there to establish these in-stream flow requirements and these protect these flows during the dry periods. In terms of singling out one activity versus another, again, you know, where the determination is made that a certain activity has an impact on public trust resources or the activity cumulatively can be seen as a waste and unreasonable use, there is the authority to regulate that and to establish requirements. You know, and in this case, the legislation specifically allows the board to establish this policy. So,
and I want to say, I mean, the remedy is if you don't like it, get a water right. And that will take probably a very long time. So most people are going to want to work with this, and if they cut themselves off, then they may very well have to perfect a water right, and that's a very cumbersome process. So that's one of the ways. And the second thing is, if you read our particular provisions very carefully, it's cannabis, but it's also other agricultural operations with a similar effect. So, again, is if you don't have a separate waiver, then presumably if you're another ag operation, you have to operate in it and there's no discrimination. So,
And I should also add in general that, you know, when I talk about the dry and the wet forbearance period, we're specifically looking at the interim flow requirements. And part of that is we didn't get to the timeline yet, but the interim flow requirements, our timeline is to have those before the board for adoption in August of 2017. We won't be able to do a comprehensive analysis on demand or a comprehensive analysis on the in-stream flows needed for summer rearing, which is one of the more difficult times to predict, especially for anadromous salmonids. So from the interim standpoint, for us just to go ahead and just have a wet and dry period will be
yeah,
the easiest
I get that
for us
part
to
too,
move
but
forward.
Using John's word, I mean, don't you think somebody's going to challenge it on a discriminatory basis? If you've got one ag commodity, taking water in August, and another one is told you can't do it anymore, and neither of them have a water right. It just seems to be a liability there that the state's going to get challenged on.
They will all need to have a water right.
Yeah. Just to clarify, I mean, this doesn't change the existing water right system. You know, in order to divert water, you either need to have an appropriative right or a riparian right. And, you know, those are requirements.
Even if you're using groundwater next to a stream?
Well, so that's a complicated issue because sometimes you can have groundwater that's connected through the subsurface, and so that could be considered also subject to the appropriative system. What this legislation does, the way I read it, is it allows the state board to craft policy that considers the impact of that groundwater diversion on those surface flows. So how that's going to play out in a regulatory construct, I don't think that's been developed yet. Dan can speak maybe more specifically to the efforts of the state board, but the legislation gives the authority to establish this policy that will comprehensively look at groundwater, surface water, and the interplay. How that is enforced and how that plays out, I think, is yet to be developed.
Yeah, and I think the way that the legislation was written is very specific to cannabis cultivation, and in some ways it has some extension of authority within it, is kind of the interpretation from our interpretation at this point. And that's specifically with the finding being made a little bit up front for groundwater, potential for groundwater and for springs, which are the two main ones that would not typically fall under our regulatory authority.
I would say in most cases that to act conservatively, you would say that they are linked, and that until you can prove otherwise, then we're going to take the most conservative approach and assume that groundwater and surface water are acting as one. That would be my advice.
Yeah, and that's essentially what our stance is.
It's more difficult to go the other way. It would take much more time.
And when it comes to groundwater, we're assuming that most of the groundwater impacts related to commercial cannabis cultivation would be addressed under the standard SGMA process. But this is just a case in the interim we see a significant impact to groundwater resources until those processes are evolved.
Go ahead, Billy.
A follow-up on the water right piece of, you know, the statement that everybody diverting water would have to have a water right. Do I understand correctly that if a cannabis producer were diverting surface water for irrigation, they wouldn't be able to continue to do that just with their riparian right with nothing else? They would have to go through small irrigation use registration or an appropriative process to be allowed to store the water to then be able to irrigate with it?
That is correct.
Okay.
And we'll get to that as well a little bit later.
I wanted to point out we just require water management plan, then that will have to be issued with the caveat that it's subject to either State Water Resource Control Board stream flow, Regional Board Water Quality stream flow, Fish and Game stream flow, the interim program, and finally water rights, whichever is stricter, but water rights has the total priority. But we do have some ag that would be covered under our cannabis permit that does not appear in the legislation. And I don't know whether you can broaden it to other ag, or you may not want to go there for statewide reasons. But we had that, so we never had to get into a court fight over whether an aerial photograph was pot or tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know your authority under the legislation, but that's something to consider.
And, you know, I think where that would play out, we wouldn't have authority to extend the principles and guidelines, the interim principles and guidelines, the way they're structured, to other resources at this time. But as a component with the small irrigation use and registration program, we're looking to extend that statewide is our intent. And upon doing that, if people wanted to, it's kind of a basically it's a time step whether or not we have enough time to be able to develop that program and extend it to all uses of water in the short term by basically next diversion season. or whether it'll take longer. But if that program is available to ag, to all ag, then they would be complying. They could sign up for it, but would need to comply with the principles and guidelines that are developed as a component of the cannabis, because they'll be nested together.
I just wanted to make a comment. So on the wet dry season, we've already heard from the growers in Trinity County that they think it's unfair. So I think you're going to get some pushback on that. And then our concern is, since we ban the import of water onto the property, so we don't let people truck water in and out, it will force them to use ponds or other devices or other methods to store water, which just pulls water out of all those creeks during the winter. When we need them to be flushed, we need them to be cleaned out. So I think you just move the problem to some other time. So I think, I don't know if that's been completely thought through, but my understanding is the growers are going to put the ponds in. Who knows if they actually get licensed. And they're just going to pull all the water out during the winter. So that's the lack of water in those tributaries and those streams during that time of year. So,
but if you're operating under a permit, you just can't put a pond in. You're doing it completely rogue.
Yep.
But yeah. There's thousands of ponds unpermitted in grape country.
Yeah. Anyway, so I think there's a big issue coming up there.
Right, and you know that's where we're looking to develop the flow requirements for the wet season to help prevent the impact of overdrafting during the wet season.
We've taken your presentation and gone totally sideways with it. So, Orso, why don't you jump back?
We can keep going. Either way you want. It's fine with me.
And then, I do want to say that in your rural regions, people, that's their drinking water also. And I don't know whether you're intending to cut off people's drinking water, but that would be poorly received. And you got a pipe there. It's going to be really hard to tell whether it's drinking water for pot. Just to give you a heads up that some of these places, they're rural. You don't have a water system, so you drink from the water, you garden from the water. And so the simplicity of a dry period is great from a regulatory standpoint, but I'm not sure how that will work.
We get there through requiring measurement. So they need to account for all the water that they're applying on their crop that's being, you know, account for that diversion during the diversion period. If they also use that water for domestic, our hunch is that likely they would be considering having two different tanks, because they may not, in that situation where they're storing water all winter, they may not want to be drinking out of that same winter that they're storing the water from. So, and even if they use the same tank, they'll need to account for how much water they're applying to the cultivated site when they're taking that water, so it balances out. So there'll be much more stricter measuring requirements as well.
And I'm not trying to be critical, because I don't know what I'd do if I was in your shoes, but I want to say, if you make it so people can't grow, they won't apply for your permit.
Mm-hmm.
They will just go continue illegal. So one of the problems we had to address is how we could get people in the system. And I don't know whether everyone says winnow down. That may be more challenging than it appears on the surface.
Yes, and you know, in general, our approach right now is we're taking a twofold approach. One is we have our existing cultivators that are out there right now, and it's trying to figure out, of those cultivators, which ones want to move into the licensing program and actually continue with a medical commercial program. Then you have your personal use, and you have everybody else. So once the commercial program is established, that is the avenue for commercial cultivators to be in, unless they're personal use. And if they're personal use and they're exceeding their local ordinances and they're not in the commercial program, they're illegal. And that's where, you know, we have increased enforcement authority as well under Senate Bill 837 to pursue those people and also get rid of remediation of sites as well. So I think right now, the way we're kind of looking at the structure is just to at least make it black and white, instead of right now it's just gray. And it's hard to tell if someone's growing personally, commercial, you know, where everything's going.
Well, like I said, you're between a rock and a hard place, and we will want to work with you no matter what you come up with.
Right.
I'm just saying it's difficult set of challenges on getting effective regulations.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you know, the with the interim principles and guidelines, they are, you know, they can be managed adaptively. And when we move forward with any type of an action, we, you know, we the board likes to have a local cooperative solution as well for implementation, as well as if that does not form, then more of a just standard regulatory approach. So there's scenarios here where, you know, from a water management standpoint, there could be more water available than what we see. From the water rights standpoint, we look at how much water somebody can take. We don't usually break that out into, you know, the total amount that they may take at a given time. We just assume they take it and we account for all that water. So usually we're not in the habit of saying your diversion period is from November to January and you're from February to March. But however, recognizing that likely there could be more water available for people to divert at different times, if they came together and came up with their own diversion plan, we would try our best to allow for those types of things as well so that people can get the water they need. But also recognizing that there is limited water available in some of these watersheds that where cannabis cultivation is currently occurring, and it may be occurring currently at rates that are not sustainable. So if that is the situation, then, you know, they're going to have to come together and figure out how to manage their watershed.
Mr. Chair, can I make a suggestion? Can we let him go through his full thing and his full presentation, and then we can have this conversation? Because I think just looking ahead here, we're missing a lot of your detail, which I think we're just coming at you with a bunch of stuff, in fairness. That's my request.
Sure.
Not to be rude, but I just...
No, I can continue.
I'd like to hear your whole program, and then, because I have questions too, but... we're all just so interested.
All right, so... moving on to implementation and enforcement. As we kind of were hitting on, you know, the goal that we have right now is to develop these interim principles and guidelines that are easily understood, and so people can understand when they can take water, when they can't take water, and also something that's easy to enforce as best as we can. One of the keys with the principles and guidelines is the State Water Board has the primary enforcement authority of those principles and guidelines. And then the component of it is kind of working with California Department of Food and Agriculture, and that if we take any enforcement actions, we notify them, because that may result in impacts to their license and vice versa. If California Department of Food and Agriculture has, you know, enforcement actions they take, they would be notifying us. And then lastly, Senate Bill 837 does not limit regulatory authority already approved under law. So the general overview that we're using right now in order to develop the interim principles and guidelines is the first step that we're working on and just completing right now is establishing the regional boundaries and the geographic scope that we're going to try to kind of catch with the first wave. We can do interim principles and guidelines. We probably won't get the whole state done this first go. The second component is to identify the desktop method that we will be using to develop the flow criteria. We don't have enough information at this point, you know, from a site-specific standpoint, to do the amount of in-stream flow work we need to do. So we're looking at different methods that are readily available that we can use and just kind of apply those broadly. Again, it's going to be a broad brush application here of flow requirements. The other component is when we go through this process, there needs to be some sort of an implementation location. So we're looking at the current United States Geologic Service in California, or Department of Water Resources, CDEC, gauge locations and where they are as our compliance gauges. And again, we recognize that this is not going to be perfect, but basically the approach we have right now is to develop a flow requirement at that gauge, and we're going through the process of identifying tributary areas that gauge represents upstream. The second process after that is to identify other locations that are within that watershed that we would use that same gauge to represent their bypass flows or their flow requirement. And the third component is the more difficult one, where watersheds that don't have any gauges in them whatsoever, they'll be reporting to the closest gauge that is the best reference gauge for that watershed. Obviously, this is far from perfect in that once one tributary upstream a gauge or downstream a gauge or in a different watershed may have more or less water use occurring from cannabis cultivation. But for the interim process, that's what we're looking at. And then once we get the information back from California Department of Food and Agriculture of where these licensed sites are, how big they are, what type of grow operations they have. We'll get a better idea of water demand in watersheds. And likewise, as I mentioned with the local cooperative solutions, if individuals don't think that the that there's more flow available in their stream system, and that gauge is not reflective, in either of those scenarios, we could have another gauge put in at that tributary level and bring the flow requirement to that area. Then after coming up with the flow requirements at the gauges, we're working through also the rest of the principles and guidelines, that the non-flow related ones that we would be including. Then the draft policy with flow requirements, additional principles and guidelines. Right now we're looking at a target of the draft being out in March to May, somewhere in that time period, for the whole policy. And then presenting the, it'll have a 60-day comment period, and then the final go into the board in August of next year. So this slide just shows kind of our draft regional boundaries right now. I think they're pretty close to being what we're going to look at, what we're going to use. There might be some fine-tuning along the edges. We've come up with 14 throughout the state. As I mentioned, during this first round, we're going to hit as, or this first year, we're going to hit as many of these as we can. Right now, our main focus areas are both the Region 1 and Region 5 Water Quality Control Boards, and then hopefully the Central Coast and South Coast would be the ones that we'll be targeting this year, and then we'd go follow up and do the rest of the state the following year. And we still haven't worked through all the details as far as whether or not some of the principles and guidelines that we develop would just apply statewide. Some might be more state applicable, but we don't think we'll get the flow requirement component done statewide by August of 2017. So just to show that those regions again, with Region 1's boundary, basically there's three. We keep the AB 2121 policy as it is because it's already an established policy area and has special requirements for it. And so we'll be working within the existing policy for what we do here. And then with some potential additional principles, guidelines specific to cannabis cultivation, but the general, there's a small irrigation use registration program already in effect in the water right process to get water rights through AB 2121. And then the North Coast and then the Klamath region. So our projected timeline. We just finished our initial public outreach at the beginning of October. We hit 8 locations throughout the state, mainly in September. As I mentioned, March to May, we'd release the draft policy, and then consideration of August 2017 for the final at the board, and then the California Department of Food and Ag's licensing program begins January 2018 as their target. So now I wanted to touch a little bit on the registration component, because this is a key component to the dry season forbearance period. Is right now there is a small irrigation use registration program. It's established for AB 2121 area. Basically, it's for 20 acre feet or less, and the primary beneficial use is irrigation heat control or frost protection. And one of the keys with the small irrigation use registration is it can be coupled with a domestic use registration as well, as long as that total use still stays under 20 acre feet. So what we'll, and I should just mention before I move on to the next program, is the nuance here is that the small domestic use registration, which is actually a size class that's more applicable to most commercial cannabis or even personal cannabis cultivation, doesn't necessarily apply. First off, it can't be used for any commercial crops. So that's the first one for all the commercial side. When we look at some of the personal use sides, it's really the outdoor irrigation component of a small domestic supposed to be incidental use. So it's really a case-by-case determination in that, you do have some people applying for small domestic use registration that might be for personal grows, but they don't have a residence on the property. And so that wouldn't be applicable. So we're working on developing a little bit better fact sheet on what would apply for kind of specifically towards cannabis cultivation, what would apply under small domestic and who would need to get the small irrigation use registration, whether it's for personal or commercial. So that brings us into the need to develop a new program, or basically extending the small irrigation use registration program statewide. And we're working on developing the general conditions. We're still working on how everything folds together, but a lot of the principles and guidelines fold into the general conditions that would be in the small use irrigation program. And the hope, again, is to have that program up and ready by next diversion season so people can collect water next wet season for use the following dry season and be established. And then one other key component, just in general, because we hit on it a little bit with the water right component, is that in the code, it essentially reads that in order for anybody to have a priority to get a California Department of Food and Agriculture license, they have to have filed a water right with the State Water Board by July 1st, 2017. So basically, our general outreach to people right now is that if you are using diverting surface water and you don't have a water right, you need to at least get your statement of diversion, your initial statement of diversion and use in by 2017. And we're working on having some additional questions and stuff so we can identify who would be moving into the small irrigation use registration program as soon as it's available. And I think that's pretty much it. These are just our resources in general. We have a website that we're still working on getting the final version up. Right now, we're just kind of piggybacking the enforcement, cannabis enforcement website, which isn't a perfect fit, but we're working on turning that more into just a portal where you can either get to principles and guidelines, get to the regional programs or enforcement or best management practices. And then that's our LIRIS list up on the board as well. It's water rights and cannabis cultivators. So anybody that's interested in receiving any future notifications should sign up for that list. Oh, my contact information's at the bottom. Sorry, I thought it was a different slide.
Mr. Chair. All right, so we'll come at you one more time here. Mm-hmm. So let me see if I understand then. So basically said that these are basically interim policy measures set forth by State Board in the world of water rights as it pertains specifically to cannabis cultivation, setting in flow criteria, right, a minimum in-stream flow criteria, that would, I would imagine, be the beginning point for then the allocation of water by math then, to say that if we have this much in-stream flow requirement and we've got this much that is potentially flow, we could allocate then above and until it's allocated to its extent, right? And that as it goes, because I think Board Member Minton's question was very good, in that the riparian registration right now, or riparian right, excuse me, does not allow you to store. But this would, it sounds like. This would allow basically a riparian right to store water in a tank or a pond. Is that correct? Or a bladder?
They would have to apply for the small irrigation use registration.
Can I ask you, I've done several registrations with water rights as a consultant, including in the AB 2121 policy. And so that basically, that's a pretty hard process to go through, frankly, especially with existing ponds, I have to say. And that's mm-hmm. mainly what I've worked in. Existing ponds are very difficult sometimes to legalize using that policy, mainly because the class one, class two stream restrictions on it. A lot of ponds are simply too big. There's egg ponds out there that are twice the size of the allowance, although that's a diversion allowance. That's not a total size allowance, I believe. And the AB 2121 policy includes fish and wildlife buy-off with the biologic components to it, including augmentation of gravel and wood recruitment. There's also the median February flow requirement that's in there. But I think that at the same time, the AB 2121 policy is very good for what it was designed to do. It is hard, I would say, to take older ponds, online ponds now, and legalize them under that policy. Has there been contemplation, Dan, to take the small irrigation AB 2121 and basically extend it to the Eel, the Mad, the Trinity, and the Klamath all the way up to the state line?
That would be the intent, but it would be extended under this program with these principles and guidelines versus the ones that you currently have and go through for the AB 2121 policy area. So it would be a slightly different program that you would be applying for, basically different conditions,
sure.
I should say, and different different steps you need to take to get your small irrigation. And I should also add that right now, you know, the bigger the project, the more difficult it is for us to analyze at the larger scale under the California Environmental Quality Act for impacts and so on and so forth. So right now, our general approach is to start small, see where we can get. So we're not at this point intending for the extension of the small irrigation use registration program to be for any on-stream reservoirs. It would just be off-stream. There may be a cap in size as well, you know, recognizing that cannabis cultivation, typically the numbers we seem to be getting back seem to be somewhere around 2 to 3 on the more in the Calaveras area, 2 to 3 acre feet per year per acre. Down in more of the coastal Santa Barbara area, we're getting closer to an acre foot per acre. So it kind of it does depend regionally, but when we look at the total water need and use for a lot of these cultivation sites, it's going to be smaller, which will enable us to get the small irrigation use registration program up faster, at least at this first step, because again, this is an aggressive timeline for us to hit.
So, two additional questions, please. One would be that water rights, in my experience, are based on time and right.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, you open this policy. This policy is adopted. Say, call it August 1st, 2017. By August 2nd, 2017, do you get 10,000 registered statements of diversion and use registered? And how then do you prioritize when there's a finite amount of water in any given watershed, tributary, or subwatershed?
And this is why we're looking to hopefully be able to expand it to all water use so everybody can take advantage of it. But with just the nuances of trying to implement the program by 2017, from an appropriative standpoint, you know, right now there's opportunity for other people to be applying for an appropriative permit right now and be in the door in front of everybody that would be moving onto this system. So there's nothing preventing somebody from, at this point, from getting in ahead from a priority standpoint. Granted, it will be a program that could be better suited for people to move to off-stream storage for at least a component of their use.
One last question, Dan. I know somebody that has a piece of property that has a pond that I actually registered as a small irrigation right. It has an acre foot in a 14-acre foot pond. We registered an acre foot because he's growing truffle trees to grow truffles in Mendocino County, a good friend of mine, and thinking about selling the property. Is that right actually? It is a small irrigated use right. It is within the AB 2121 area. Could that be used for marijuana under these this legislation or existing water rights?
They would still have to apply with any principles and guidelines we have, but the pond itself could be used. For a storage vehicle.
Okay, thank you. And I'll let my board members ask questions. Thank you.
Okay. Board Member Minton and then Board Member Gusti.
Thank you. I may be mixing things up, so tell me if I'm remembering incorrectly. Is the small irrigation use, if you have a pond, is there a rule that you can't take out trees to put in that pond? You basically have to put it in an area that's already been cleared or cultivated?
That in the AB 2121 policy area, that is correct.
Okay. So would that requirement be foreseen across the board for these small irrigation registrations?
We're looking right now to see if we can, you know, and this is all in the developmental stage, of course, but looking to see if we have smaller storage areas, we can extend that to undisturbed land and that the footprint would be relatively small. The main purpose of that is what we've noticed a lot is when you have the restrictions that it has to be a disturbed area is somebody goes and puts in their pond and then says, I didn't know. So trying to make sure that we're, you know, out ahead of everything and that, we're just trying to figure out what the best process forward is for protecting the environment as we move through the process. And we've identified that as a potential issue right now. So if we can front load it with the environmental protection components and allow for small disturbance, that may likely be a better situation than saying disturbed area only and having people disturb it.
Thanks. And does the disturbed area thing apply to tanks too or just ponds?
I'm going to assume it applies to anything under the small irrigation use registration, but I'm not positive on that. I can find out if you want me to.
I'm sure I'll learn it over time anyway. But thank you.
Mm-hmm. So actually, this may be a question for Mr. Noren, but you know, so 20 acre feet is 6.5 million acres. It's not that little green tub that you showed in your pictures.
Gallons, you mean?
6.5 million gallons, right? So it's a sizable pond. At some point, you know, doesn't dam construction permits come in terms of cumulative impacts? If everybody's building a 6.5 million gallon pond, this is all under the assumption that growers are going to be compliant. Okay, I mean, that's a big assumption. We're dealing with people who have been outlaws for years, and now we want them to all get proper and line up in a row. But in terms of cumulative impacts, dam safety issues, dam distribution, I mean, there's a lot of layers to this onion. But in terms of watershed cumulative impacts, if everybody's allowed 6.5 million acres...
Gallons, sorry.
I don't know why.
My experience, Greg, is that a pond up to 49 acre feet is not subject up to a capacity of 49 acre feet is not subject to the division of dam safety, I believe. There's a height restriction to that, by the way, as well. You do need a local grading permit. Like, we're trying to permit a pond for a bit. Okay. But in Sonoma County, I would say, because we are actually going through the process of doing an irrigation registration for a vineyard development, straight up vineyard. And so in talking to some of the staff at State Board, then we proposed and proposed the location, the dam construction, the volume of pond, and then basically you enter into that process of seeking registration and right through the diversion of statement in use and then formal registration through that class. In Sonoma County, you get a grading permit. Other than that, there's not too much more to it.
Well, like, and we heard Member Gantz say, you know, Trinity County, Mendocino County, there are no grading requirements on building these structures. And it looked like it's outside the AB 2121 jurisdiction as well. You know, again, in terms of the issue that I've always been concerned about is cumulative impacts, even though we're diverting water at high flow times of the year, you could still divert all the water in a small stream if everybody's got 6.5 million gallons
yes.
That they're putting in a hole in the ground. So well, it's not these little tanks that I'm worried about. It's this
no,
large
I get it.
Construction. Because what we're talking about is commercialization of a new commodity that may come on very quickly, where other commodities have transitioned over time, you know, hops to prunes to pears to grapes. This is all coming at once. On the assumption that a fair percentage of growers will be compliant, and that remains to be seen.
Well, and I think in my experience with AB 2121, it very much accounts for cumulative impacts. In fact, that's a big piece of it, and that it is a diversion, right? But it also has a restriction. AB 2121 is from the Mattole River down to the San Pablo or Petaluma River. It doesn't include the Eel, and it doesn't include the Mad or the Trinity or anything north. It does have cumulative impact consideration in it, and that could be rather difficult in watersheds that already have established water rights because you have to maintain a certain amount of your median February flow. It gets actually fairly complicated fairly fast, and that's why I actually think the AB 2121 policy is actually very good. It's protective of Class 1 and Class 2. It is right in time. It has cumulative impact consideration. It's too big, though, because if you do have everybody doing 20 acre feet, that's a heck of a lot of water. But at the same time, though, you know, it is very cumbersome to go through. It took me 2 years to get through the State Board and Fish and Game to write off on it and get all the way through for one, a fairly simple one, existing pond. We didn't even have to build it. It was simply legalizing an existing pond that had been there since 1970 or something. And Dan, let me ask you from the standpoint of have any idea how many of these could be coming in the door at State Board into water rights? I know water rights got how many extra staff? You got 25 extra staff or something like that?
Now you're going to make me remember my math. I think it was 22, I think, is what we ended with. From the registration component, we're not entirely sure what we're going to see at the beginning, but just knowing how many cultivators are out there and so on, it could be upwards of somewhere between 10 to 50,000 in the state.
Yeah, that's huge. And the thing is, too, is that given, again, the cumulative impact component here is the existing problem. Right, that's not something that's new. What we're at, what the state's asking for is to people to come out of the dark, whether they do it or not's the question, and to legalize water use and diversion within some semblance of order, because there's no order right now. It's the Wild West out there right now. And to me, you got to start somewhere, right? And I think that this is fairly bold, and that it's going to be fast times in state board water rights for a long time, I would imagine, because. And again, just because the water rights are right in time, and it is cumulative impacts, that you, if you're the last guy in the bus, you may be out of luck, especially. And by the way, I fully applaud setting some type of minimum in-stream flow that gives the state of California the right to say no more. Nope, that's it. We're done. And in fact, some of these watersheds could be there, I would guess. They're over-allocated. Right. They're over-allocated before you ever legalize anything. I think this is going to be very interesting.
Yeah, and the other thing, as I mentioned, that we're looking at is controlling the size of what type of storage could be put in because of the cumulative impacts and us being able to analyze that from the interim standpoint, potentially as you move forward and get more into the region-specific long-term interim principles and guidelines that would be matched more up with like an AB 2121. Then that type of program could be expanded depending on where it is and the water availability and demand would be taken. You know, we'd have a chance to look closer at demand and water availability at that point and kind of come up with and the in-stream flow needs as well, region.
What I think is quite interesting too is that, you know, looking at it at the ordinance process, because the ordinance process is not the state of California, it's local, state, and county government. And to me, I've looked at a couple of them, and it's a bit mishmash right now. You know, I know Siskiyou County allows no outdoor grows to be legal, and their indoor grows are have a certain size criteria to them. Santa Rosa, I'm a consultant at an engineering, local engineering and environmental firm, and this week I got three calls with potentially three jobs of people that are developing and building buildings in city Santa Rosa, because we're seen to be the ground zero on this right now. It's very interesting the effect of what is potentially coming with Prop 64 with this whole move here now. It seems to me that at the state level it would be, if possible, to try to get a handle on and some information on it about if it's going to be limiting. It strikes me that the limitation could come from a local ordinance to companion with this water right move and with some of the other moves that the Department of Food and Ag or others out here, because 6.5 million gallons, frankly, or 20 acre feet of water is just a heck of a lot of water. And you could probably grow, I don't know, lots and lots and lots of cannabis with that. And I don't know where the limits are. Water cannot be the limiting factor, I would imagine, here. There's just not enough water in the world for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and both the initiative and the existing legislation, they cap growth for the first 5 years. So that to an acre for commercial. And there's some nuances to that where if you can have multiple people that can potentially make it bigger on a parcel. And the idea that they have is really to first, and Department of Food and Ag controls how many licenses they give out. So there might only be a certain amount of licenses. And like you mentioned, the local county can have their own ordinance and they can say, no, you can't grow any commercial cannabis here at all. So that's kind of how from the state level they're trying to approach it is by first looking at, let's try to get the existing, you know, cultivators into the regulatory process so we see what's going on before we start to expand a program to anything larger.
Yeah, I think, you know, again, it is a bit of the Wild West, and it's way out of the barn at this point. And to try to get a handle on it in a regulatory sense is very, very difficult, no matter what we do. Even if we do nothing and continue to do this, it's going to be difficult. By the way, I applaud you for doing this. I think it's going to be quite interesting and frankly organic to see how this grows and changes and fits into actual water rights, because this is a bit of an anomaly in water rights from what I know of water rights. And I know the state's trying very hard to figure this out, as are we, and as are a lot of other agencies, I know.
Thank you.
Okay, board member Gant.
So I think the program's good. I think, at least from my perspective in Trinity County, you overestimate the capacity of the growers. We have a 3-page application for a county permit, and we can't get people through a 3-page application. It's not within their capacity to do the application. So to think that they can apply or even figure out that they need a permit for a pond or they can't clear for their tanks or whatever happens to be, they're not there. I mean, these are people, the last grow is that I saw was about 2,000 plants. They're living in tents. They push the garbage to the back of the property. And that's what a grow is like in some of the rural areas. And they won't be able to figure their way through this process. So I think you're going to have a few of the growers will be able to do it. I know that we have the new ordinance in Trinity County, and it's been in place for a month and a half. We have four people who have applied. We have a number of people who have meetings, appointments to talk to the county. But that, I mean, we're hoping we get to 50. 50 out of 5,000 is we'll think we're going to be doing good. So unless it's simple, unless you have a lot of enforcement and drive out the people who aren't following the rules, I don't know. I don't know how you take an unregulated black market economy and get them honest. I don't know. It's going to be a lot of work, and so that was just, we were shocked. I mean, the growers were all complaining because we were going to limit it to 500 licenses, and everybody was up in arms, and we packed the Performing Arts Center with people, and we give them a license in 4. That was it. So that was a shock. So I think that's kind of what you're looking at, and they're not all going to be breaking down your door to comply.
Well, just in response to that, this is Matt St. John. By having regulation, it gives us more tools to then take enforcement actions. So we and Water Rights and the Office of Enforcement fully in our work plans have fully anticipate to be taking a lot of enforcement actions over the coming years.
I had a question. You said people can apply for permits right now. How many have applied?
For which kind of permit? For an appropriative or?
Your interim permit. I thought I heard you said that people could apply right now.
No, not for the interim permit yet.
Okay.
That one, with the registration program, we won't have available until next fall. In AB 2121 policy area, they can apply, and there are some commercial cannabis small irrigations that have come through. It's only a handful. I think it's like 2 to 3, maybe one more.
Are those geographically centered?
You know, I don't know where they are located in the AB 2121 area.
And then probably the most important question, what do you want us to do to help you? We're up here. We're going forward with our program. It's a little different in nature and scope. It's meant to be coordinatable with yours at any moment in time. Do you want us just to keep proceeding, or you want us to turn over names? I mean, where are you coming from on how we're a good citizen regional board?
For our program, we've been reaching out, and we're learning more and more about your waiver of waste discharge that you have established already, and trying to, you know, we'll be outreaching to see what components, if we should be folding some of those, what's working, what's not working, to be folded into the principles and guidelines as well. Some of those overlap very well. If just in general, you know, the big thing that we've been trying to outreach amongst people is best management practices. We don't know a lot about cannabis cultivation. So if in site visits, you see best management practices, those types of things, and think that this is something that a standard that all cultivators should be held to, then those are things we can fold into our principles and guidelines. And outreach. So, I mean, outreach.
One of the pillars of our... Is my mic on today? Now it's on. One of the pillars of our approach, of course, is outreach and education, and we've, using cleanup and abatement account funds, have funded the Eel River Recovery Project and the Mendocino County Resource Conservation District. They've developed some BMP guides that address not only pollution prevention-based BMPs, but also water conservation related BMPs. So those are resources that are available to the state, and we encourage you to use them.
Thank you.
And I have no idea the validity, but the Humboldt Time Standard said there were 3,300 permits to date in Humboldt County that had applied, and the Board of Supervisors extended that to December, and then that's in litigation whether that's legal to do. But that's a sign there are some numbers starting to sign up in some geographical locations.
Mr. Chair, since Mr. Norton threw out the bait, I'll take it. But I want to reiterate a point that I've made. And David, you talked about you know, people coming forward for indoor grows, and we talk about water diversion. A little off topic here, Dan, but I think for our board, these hydroponic indoor grows are going to have wastewater, and they can have a lot of wastewater. And where that's going to go, how that's handled, how it can overwhelm municipal wastewater treatment plants with chemicals that might not normally be taken out. I just want to reiterate my concern over what could potentially be a tremendous amount of waste, contaminated wastewater that could potentially overwhelm biological treatment systems, could go into groundwater, could go into stormwater, or and then end up directly in surface water. So just want to kind of keep that fresh, keep it out there, because as grows become more industrial, become more indoor, I see that as a problem on the horizon.
I think you're right on the mark with that. It's going to be a serious problem.
Well, there also could be a rush on putting wells in, right? Whether they're riparian wells or whether they're just land-based wells. This could have the effect of saying, well, I'm not going to use surface water at all then, because, you know, I'm not going to go through that because it's too darn complicated, and I'm just going to, you know, get Bob's drilling out here, and I'm going to pop a well in here. Whether I could find water or not, it's a whole different thing. But in Sonoma County, a water well is basically a ministerial permit over the counter at PRMD. So that's a fairly straight-ahead process. Yeah, and I agree, Greg. I think whether it be an impact of putting a well in, whether that water, by the way, if you go grow indoor in a big scale way in the city of Santa Rosa, you're still using that by definition. That's a surface water diversion at a Russian river that goes through a POTW that goes to the geysers and has all kinds of, you know, energy and water footprint to it. So the impact is very widespread no matter what.
Right. And this may sound funny, but we almost are looking at pretreatment standards for greenhouse cannabis growers before they discharge to the community system. And I haven't seen anyone even taking a scratch and a pencil at that, but I think Greg is absolutely right. It's like squeezing a sponge. If you block it somewhere and there's the market and people are going forward in their business, they're going to move to the next area, and you squeeze that and they'll come back over here. And so I know in Humboldt County, I've seen attorneys' desks that are just stacked this high with all indoor growing apps. So we'll earn our keep solving this problem.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Thank you. I just, before we wrap up the discussion, I wanted to make sure I said thank you to Dan for being such a good sport about us interrupting your presentation and peppering you with questions that have been all over the map. It's been very informative, so thank you. Yes.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah, I want to echo that thank you, Dan, for coming. It's been very informative. And as I've told the board members, we are going to piggyback on Dan's presentation and use this as an opportunity to give you a brief update on the implementation of our conditional waiver.
Good.
I don't know if you want to hear from Josh Curtis now on that or take the public comment. That's your choice.
I think let's get all the staff presentations, then public comment.
Yep.
And then I believe board member Hales needs to be out of here by 4. So if you want him to hear the erudition of your comments, you got to get it all done by 4.
All right. Well, Dan, welcome to Region 1 Cannabis Discussions. That's right. I'm ready. Good afternoon, Chairman Corbett, members of the board, Josh Curtis, a member of your staff. We anticipate questions from you on our program and have a number of questions from past board meetings that we wanted to try to address head on. So I'm going to give really a very quick overview of some of the major pieces of our program, where we are, and then try to answer a couple questions that have come up in past board meetings, and then open it up for more questions, which I'm sure there won't be any of those, but we'll see. So the just to start out, the enrollment numbers, which I think Patty's just handed out to you, we're currently at 682 completed enrollments as of the 17th. There are quite a few in process, still 181 in process, and every day we get more and more. You know, from the 9-1 update, the last time I had a numbers run, it's about a 50% increase, and so we're seeing a significant increase each month. We have two enrollment enforcement letter efforts. So we, in April, you had a fairly large update on kind of the enrollment enforcement process that Yvonne West gave to you. So we've started that process. We've sent out letters to Chemise Creek and Lower East Branch of South Fork Eel, and then actually returned to the Mad River, which we had sent letters, I think, in February, February timeframe. So we returned to that location, saw how many people had enrolled, and for those who didn't, we then resent them this more official 13260 letter. So we have about 347 property owners that we've sent letters to. Of those, roughly 34% of them have enrolled in that from that letter effort. Those are of the people who picked them up. So there's about a 20% group that just never picked up their letters. So of those that picked them up, we're looking at about 34% enrollment. We've also noticed that others who are nearby, but we either missed because they were right outside the watershed, or we just didn't see them in our aerial review. So they weren't part of our letter campaign. They actually have started to enroll as well. So we are noticing that just neighbors nearby that hear their friends are getting these letters are also enrolling. So that's a bonus to the program. For next steps, we're going to be looking at, you know, with those two letter enrollment enforcement efforts, there's a varying degrees of effort and different decisions we have to make about each one. So there's things we have to do for those who are non-responsive, don't pick up their letters at all. Some that picked up their letters and ignored the letters. Some have responded and said they're trying to enroll. Some saying they're not growing. Each one of those requires us to do a different action in the next step. And so our next steps are going to be going through and figuring out each of those stages, who gets another letter, an NOV, who might get a call saying, you know, from aerial imagery, it looks like you are growing 5,000 square feet. You said you're doing 1,000. Let's have a discussion, those type of things. So that's the next step for those, and then we'll be building in our new, we'll do another watershed effort with another letter of round of letters coming soon. I'm currently thinking January, because I'll mention here further down that we're going to be hiring 5 new staff, and I'm kind of hoping that they're going to be able to take that effort on. So I'm looking at January after the holidays. Some questions have come up recently in past board hearings on aerial imagery and how we use aerial imagery. I know Chairman Cormitt's very interested in this. So I just wanted to touch on some of the things we're doing with that. We have, we use aerial imagery and, you know, both satellite and other types of aerial imagery consistently through our program in many different ways. The enrollment enforcement, when we look at a watershed to do enrollment enforcement, we're actually going in and using aerial imagery and the CIPS program, which you've been presented on before. That's the Cannabis Identification and Prioritization System. So we can use that. And then we also go through and vet all those sites and see which parcels we need to send letters to. So that's one way we use it. We use it in our regular enforcement actions, cleanup and abatement orders, all that. So we use it throughout the program. As we move forward in our progressive enforcement process for enrollment enforcement, we need to get more recent high-resolution imagery. And there's a lot of the imagery that we use, the Google imagery, those type of things, those are older. So it's sometimes hard to use that as we move forward, especially when we get towards an ACL. We have to have something to be able to show more significantly, yes, this is evidence, essentially. The burden of proof is on us to prove they were growing. So what we've done to deal with that is this year, we actually got early access to the NAEP, which I cannot remember the name of that, what that acronym means, but it's basically one of the large-scale aerial imagery systems. The NAEP 2016 imagery, we got early access to that, and we're utilizing that in our enrollment enforcement. It was very useful to have, but when we got it, it was draft and rough, and so sometimes it didn't always line up correctly with the geo-reference, and so there was some troubles there, but it still was very useful to get because it was this year's data, which is a big help to us. We are also looking at contracting out and getting access to our own overflights to do aerial imagery for us for our needs. We looked at doing watershed-wide geo-referenced high-resolution aerial imagery, and the costs of that were quite high, on the order of $300,000 for one, Huck 8 watershed. We were looking at the MAD at the time. Since this is something we think we'll need periodically, year in, year out, we're going to need this effort. To do a $3,000 effort at one time seems like it was not the best option for us, but if we can get that funding or find a way to make that cheaper, we certainly would still be interested in it. What we're looking at instead for the short term is a targeted approach where we actually look at those places that we've sent those enrollment letters to, and we have a overflight of those specific parcels, taking the imagery of those parcels, and that's a much cheaper process. You're looking at about $15,000 for 100 sites. And so we are in process right now with essentially a pilot project in partnership with Humboldt Bay Municipal Water District. They've agreed to fund and contract out essentially a test for us in the MAD. The scope of work looks like it's complete, and we might be flying as early as next week and going to those locations in the MAD that we have sent enrollment enforcement letters to. If that process works and is really useful to us, that may be one of the main ways we move forward. Alongside that, we're also doing a discretionary contract currently, writing basically the proposal stage for discretionary contracts, which would use that and likely a more expansive version of that throughout our region in order to get the imagery that we need. And then I'll touch a little bit later down on some of our staffing efforts to increase our GIS capability to do some of this work in a much less person-intensive effort. So I'll touch on that in a little bit. There's been some questions on Proposition 64 and how that would affect our program. I did some fairly significant research this week on that, and the main thing that may impact our program from Prop 64, if it passes, is an increase in cultivators, right? If there is a market that really drives that up, that's going to be the biggest impact to our program. The way our program is set up, it actually folds into to pretty much any of the regulatory efforts that are going on currently. Prop 64 is designed to essentially overlay with MRSA, which is no longer MRSA, I guess, because they changed it from marijuana to cannabis, but it overlays with those regulations. It actually changes the Bureau of Medical Cannabis Regulation to the Bureau of Marijuana Control. So that's one of the things in Prop 64. It changes their name, but it keeps all of their responsibilities and the responsibilities of other agencies, including the State Water Board, to be similar to what the current regulations are under the Medical Marijuana Act. The track and trace system that's required under MRSA just folds over as well. Prop 64 directs that to be used for non-medical cannabis use. The cultivation system and how they determine what sizes of cultivation and types of cultivation are allowed is the same as it currently is under MRSA. The main difference that I could find is that after 5 years, the Prop 64 would allow for grows larger than an acre, which we heard about previously in the previous discussion. And then just on this, I would say that our EO and a few select staff, including myself, will be meeting with the chief and the deputy chief of the new Bureau of Medical Cannabis Regulation early in November to start, you know, making sure we're building that connection and communicating with them as well. I think it's important to mention that there's an effort to do a statewide permit for cannabis that's just truly just in its nascency, but it's looking at a very fast timeline as well. They have a draft charter. That's as far as they've gone with that process, but it is looking like they're trying. The current direction is that they accomplish and get it approved by the board by August of 2017. I think that seems perhaps too aggressive, and talking with some of the staff, it might end up being later towards January of 2018. But since that's the date that MRSA and the Prop 64, those regulations kick in, there is a drive to try to make sure that that permit is available by that date. And then the state board executive has informed us that it's likely that that statewide permit would replace our own. So it would be a permit for the whole state that would replace the regional permits. We don't necessarily know whether we agree with that or not. That's just kind of what we've been informed is their current plan. And we're working closely with them to ensure that, you know, they learn from our lessons learned and make sure that they craft a permit that works for our region and takes our concerns into account and hopefully makes an easy transition if it does end up replacing ours, for those who are in our program to easily transition into the statewide permit. I mentioned personnel. We were budgeted five new personnel and have put in a request to essentially form a whole new unit, and it's a cannabis regulatory unit. That's the name of the new unit. That justification and the justification to hire those five personnel are at State Board Human Resources and are essentially awaiting their authorization. So we're in a holding pattern until they're able to process that. I mentioned that one of those positions, we've actually designed it very specifically to be a GIS-focused position, requesting GIS certifications and having that be a major part of their skill set. We have that skill set in-house in a number of areas, but it's kind of fragmented, and we've definitely found the need to really have that skill in the cannabis program and have it be kind of someone that's their main focus, and so they can help us do some of the analysis and maybe design an algorithm similar to what was done for SIPs to help us locate and identify cannabis grows faster and easier. And then lastly, on direction from the EO, we are currently crafting an 18-month work plan for the cannabis program to provide milestones and really to help ensure we're meeting the board's and staff's priorities for that program and for the new unit when they all get staffed up to make sure that they can hit the ground running and they have a nice plan forward as soon as they come on board. And that's all I had to pass. And with that, I'll take any questions.
Board member.
Thank you. Can you update me on our third-party certification program? How many folks do we have, if any?
We have four.
Okay. And that's moving along, and they're doing their job and turning stuff in?
Yes. We just the numbers that I gave you includes the third-party enrollments. I don't have the breakdown to that, but I should actually start tracking that because I think that's a good piece of information.
And we've got the information that are from those third party gets passed along to us, so everybody's in the mm-hmm. system.
Yes, they process the fees and all that. I know we just received a fairly large fee chunk from one of the third parties, so they're processing a good number.
Great, thanks.
But I'll create that breakdown because that's actually a really good question for future updates.
Thanks. Secondly, just to comment on the aerial imagery, you may want to shop around and check with different contractors. Prices vary pretty widely for that service. One of the largest costs is just getting the plane off the ground. Once you're up, your data collection can be comparatively, a little bit less expensive. But my point in saying that is that you can couple data collection needs in a single flight. And it sounds like there's other programs that we heard from earlier today that want to do some aerial photography. And so maybe there's some cost savings and cost sharing with other programs. You can collect LIDAR and air photos on the same flight, maybe forward-looking infrared or something like that. So I don't know, maybe something to look at internally.
Yeah, thank you, Board Member Hales. That's a good idea. And we are, in our discretionary contract, we are looking at doing LIDAR. This first test we're doing doesn't, the contractor that the Humboldt Bay Municipal Water District, they weren't doing LIDAR. So, but we are looking at that.
Because you can do the LIDAR and the photos in the same flight.
Yeah, that's our hopeful goal.
Great.
Kelly?
So what are our plans for the new Type 1C cottage industry license? How are we going to define them, or have we even gotten to that point yet?
I haven't looked into that at all, so I don't have an answer for you, but I certainly will now look into it, and I can get back to you with an answer for that.
Because we've had a number of growers who want that license, the cottage grow, and we didn't have any water board program. They didn't fit into all that.
It's under 2,000 square feet, is that? But it's outdoor. I'll look into it. I'll get back to you. I don't think currently they wouldn't fit in unless they were presenting an environmental impact, a discharge or something of significance. But I can get back to you on that, Board Member Gant.
And the other thing to think about, so as Trinity County was going through this ordinance and we did the urgency ordinance and 45 days later we did a renewal of it, and at that meeting the Board of Supervisors decided that they were going to change their definition from following the MRSA definition of size, which is canopy, to ours, which is cultivation area. The growers absolutely went nuts because they're not growing in enclosures. They're growing 40 plants over here, and they're growing 30 over there. And a lot of them who think they're going to become the Napa Valley of marijuana growing are actually interspersing other trees. They're growing vegetables. They're growing apple trees. They're growing other stuff. So their area of growing is enormous. And our Board of Supervisors wanted to use the Water Board's definition of cultivation area because the guys can go out with a laser measure and measure the area and say you're compliant or not compliant or which area you fall into. MRSA, of course, does it by canopy coverage. That's what the growers want, but that's really hard to enforce. So how are we going to sync MRSA's definition with canopy coverage with how a lot of the growers are actually growing in this multi-ag cultivation area thing that they're doing?
So that's a good question. I think that currently we don't have to. I mean, there's not a requirement for us to meet the same size requirements that is being put forward by MRSA and by the Prop 64. Those are licensing requirements that are being brought forth by the Food and Ag Department. And they have a different focus than us. Our focus is on, you know, the environmental impact, waste discharge, sediment impacts, and those are property-wide issues. And I think that when, you know, I wasn't here when the waiver was adopted, but I think it was a very smart move to, when looking at enrollment, looking at a property-wide impact. Because if someone is growing with lots of other things growing in between, that all has an impact. If, you know, if it's 3,000 square foot of cannabis, but 7,000 extra square feet of strawberries or something, and that has a significant impact, and all the roads to get into it have an impact, and how those roads are built and water storage. Those are all things that, you know, that are property wide and impact on the environment. And so that's how the order was developed. So I think currently we don't have to change that. I don't know how the statewide permit is going to look at that. And there might be reasons long-term to look at merging our sizes with the sizes that that MRSA or Prop 64, the Food and Drug Administration, are using. But currently, I wouldn't suggest that we would do that.
So for the grower, the example was he has a quarter acre, 5,000 square feet, and he has the marijuana plants on it, and then he has other ag, but it's all fenced in. And when code enforcement came out, they just looked at the whole enclosure and said, you're over the 2,000 because that's what he wanted to be under, because it's not all marijuana. So how are we going to handle that when you have this multi-plant enclosure? How are we going to measure that?
So, and by weed, you're in the water board?
Just making sure.
Yeah.
So how we do that, you know, we look at the we look at the size of the cultivation of cannabis to determine the 2,000 or less, or 2,000 or over. So even if it's in an enclosed area that has mixed use, we'll look at the cannabis pieces to determine whether they meet the 2,000 square feet or not. Once they meet 2,000 feet of cannabis, then we look property wide for all the other impacts. And so their plan in addressing and meeting their best management practices, all that, is a property wide issue. But the determination of 2,000 square feet or not is based on not canopy cover, but square footage of cannabis.
Is there a square foot number you use per plant?
I'm not out in the field to do that. My understanding of their discussions is that it's not per plant. It's the kind of the space right around the plant that requires operation. So they would go out, and if you had a 6-foot barrel, let's say they're growing in barrels, right? 6-foot barrel, but there's a tiny plant in it. Well, it's the couple feet around the barrel, because it's the operations that you have to do around that barrel that makes the impact. Getting a nod yes, so I'm in the right
spot. So are there guidelines then that you could offer the counties, like how you do that measurement, so that they are at least they're consistent with how you measure? Because they'd like to use water qualities measurements of cultivation area, not canopy.
Some of that is likely in our FAQ, our FAQ, but if not, I have certainly no problem with scheduling a meeting with our staff and the code enforcement staff at any of the counties to help with that process, certainly.
Yeah, they were hoping. They like the fenced-in area because that was easy for them to do.
It is.
Okay. So who would he contact to talk about that and how the measurement's done?
Probably Diana Henriel, who manages that unit, the compliance assurance unit. Or Case and Grady behind me is a good contact as well.
Mr. Chair, Josh, may I have one question? How many third-party applicants do you have in queue?
I think we're over 8. Do you remember? Right around 8 in queue.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Anyone else? I would like to see our criteria now for counting, because part of this whole thing of having or other associated ag was to try and get out of these problems. So if you have a fenced area, it's pretty hard to me to argue the tomatoes don't have the same ag effect as the marijuana plant across the aisle, and therefore you don't have to get into measuring the marijuana. You measure the cultivation area to simplify it. Otherwise, I think we're going to have a lot of interest in French gardening, where you have many species intervening, where it's almost impossible to measure. So I would like to see that actual language and our thought process. And I've heard some of the same problems Kelly has and some of the same questions from growers. And so I think it's very important we define this quickly. And to the extent counties want to make theirs consistent with us, that's great. And then I just wanted to reaffirm board goals are that the program be public, that there be a priority on aerial, and we want an analysis as soon as you can on the comparative approaches, which one takes more labor. Because a way to look at that, this whole thing is a fight over how we can get the number of permits processed per staff hour. And we can have the most beautiful program in the world, and if it takes too much labor, it's gone. It's no good. So the more it doesn't have to be a formal analysis, but some kind of analysis. We tried this, and, you know, in 3 years, we got 20 permits. We tried this. In 2 years, we got 200 permits, and we tried this, and we got 300 permits. Something so that there's good guidance what's working. And I suspect measuring an estimate of the labor per enrollment is a good way to do that. I do want to say, of course, when you're starting up programs, there's an immense labor. So you got to use some horse sense in interpreting the data.
So, Chairman Corbett, I think that's a great idea. And my first thought when you said that was that, you know, while we've been doing these first two letter efforts, we've been doing, basically we've been building all the structure along with that in order to track those letter enforcements too. So that effort, which was quite large, we now don't have to do in that next phase. So it might be better, that information may be better served after a few more months, a few more of these efforts, so that we can get a sense of not having to build the program while we're figuring it out, right? Like, it's hard to give you an estimate now because of that, I guess.
And then lastly, I just got done attending a water district seminar, and it was on the use district use of drones and the rules and regulations for them looking for water leaks, fire, cannabis. So a lot of those water districts are, and the Obama administration just issued some guidelines for those, and we ought to look at it. There's one provision in there that may be very hard for us of keeping it in sight, but if you're from a road and you can do a certain amount and you are following up on specific areas, again, you've cut down the time of going through multiple locked gates and some other things, and if you can verify they're still growing, that ought to be one option that ought to be explored. And I'm not sure we'll be real popular in pot country, but I do want to say it's being used by other public entities all the time. Right. And by the way, the federal laws, it's a violation of federal law to shoot down a drone, but good luck on enforcement. Yeah. I'll defer to somebody else on enforcement, but I do want to say that we should consider employing that under certain appropriate circumstances, and even if it's only 10 or 20% of the program, that's huge. Like Hiya Palm, you can run one up Main Street and you'd run out of film, you know, before you got the job done. But there's probably nothing there that you couldn't use a drone to just re-verify if that's what you want. So anyway, I'd take a look at that. And I'll try and, like I said, I'm trying to get there's an attorney that specializes in it. For the state, it's always hard to contract with outside attorneys, but he's written some articles. I have not seen those, but I'm going to try and get those for you.
Thank you. And I know that Fish and Wildlife and NOAA, so Cal Fish and Wildlife and NOAA, have used drones through oil spills. They used it at Refugio when I was in my previous job.
Thank you, Board Member Hales.
Oh, yeah. So I know that it's possible. I do know that the hoops they had to leap through were fairly significant, but I know that it is a possibility. I would remind the board that we can't even buy more cell phones because of IT restrictions that the state provides. But, so drones might provide.
Well, you might be able to contract with someone and it'd be a lot cheaper than a plane. Although you have to have a certified pilot's license, so there's going to be a charge. But I just want to say that anything we can do to save labor is smart, and even if you can't use it for more than 10%, that's good. And we'll deal with how many are shot down, you know. I mean, that's just a matter of economics. Or leave it to the contractor.
Yeah. point well taken.
So you can have a little report here, drone shot down.
I look forward to that.
Okay, any other? Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry, I apologize. Al Gerhardt.
My name is Al Gerhardt. There are some concerns, and also Farm Bureau has some concerns. Now, the Ag Commissioner's working on rules for the grow areas in the rural area. Also, PRMD is having some hearings on things. The Ag Commissioner part of it is looking at indoor grows, and I believe they're looking at 50 by 50 or 2,500 square feet that would be enclosed. And I don't know, you know, how this is going to affect traditional agriculture. Also, if you've got problems with odors, and if the odors, if you put restrictions, is this going to affect agriculture? Also, the wastewater disposal and the wastewater used on ag crops, is there going to be problems? Are these going to affect ag crops? Also, you've got city grows and county grows where the city, you've got going through your wastewater plant and you're using the wastewater to grow agriculture crops and forage for cattle. I was wondering about where they're using roof catchments for water, and they can use the catchment from their grow thing, from their residence and stuff, to gather water where they put it either in tanks or ponds. One thing with tanks, you don't have the evaporation, so you get to use more of your water that you catch. And I don't know, there's lots of questions as what's going to happen and what's going to happen with the water. Thank you.
Right. I just wanted to say this is moving so fast, and because it's a new program, we do have to constantly make adjustments, and there's a real positive role the Farm Bureau can bring by getting those issues to us in writing and to our staff and maybe a copy to the board. You have a chance to really affect things because we're just stumbling along the best we know how, and it is a complex area.
Yeah, well, we've got a lot of questions and no answers.
Right. Well, get the questions in writing, and I think that's how they ultimately get answered. And sometimes we don't have immediate answers, even to really good questions and essential questions that need to be answered. But we work on it, and if you bring it to our attention, you got the best chance of getting a good answer.
But you've got the Regional Water Board, you've got your Fish and Wildlife, and all the fish organization, NOAA and stuff that can be affected by the wastewater.
Right. It's very complex. I don't know how the average citizen follows it or even can be expected to follow it, but still, I'm glad you guys are. Do the best you can, and that's what we're trying to do, too.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, sir. Any other board questions or comments? Okay, I think we're close to concluding this part of the meeting. Okay, well, let's see what we can. If we got to be out of here by 5, we need to be in executive session like yesterday.